Why did you go on about that dye colour? Why did that hook him?
He is betrothed to a lady of Elizabeth's bedchamber, Tristan answered. We studied portraits of her. She is very taken with that particular colour, and it is a difficult colour to come by with English or even European dyes. There seems to be a match of affection as well as opportunity, so I guessed that he would know her preferences and also want to know how to please her. Seems I guessed correctly.
Is right you did, I agreed, although not so much affection, he doesn't want the odd discreet diversion. I thank you for that as well.
It seemed the least I could do for the time you've donated to my cause today.
We squeezed round a tight corner into a larger street. He might more easily have dropped back and let me go ahead of him. If he had, things might have come out differently. But intent as he was on the conversation, he was desirous of remaining abreast of me, his eyes upon mine. He tried to pass through a space too narrow for the both of us. In doing so, he brushed. I don't say banged into, or jostled, but merely brushed. The shoulder of a tosser in fancy dress and a long face, leaning against a wall, sucking on a long-stemmed pipe and sulking. He probably hadn't managed to get an audience with old Elizabeth like his ma told him to expect he would. Tristan didn't even notice, but in the corner of my eye I saw this tosser giving my man a sharp look. I would be happy to strike up a working relationship with you, Tristan Lyons, so I would, I said. I can imagine all manner of ways we might be of mutual benefit. So if you're ever in Southwark again, stop in. He paused a moment and regarded me, and I regarded him back as it pleased me to do so. But at the same time I threw a glance back at the tosser in the fancy dress, who had dislodged himself from the wall and was now giving Tristan a thorough inspection from hat to shoes and back up again. I took Tristan's arm firmly and pulled him along.
"What's troubling you?" he asked, with a glance back over his shoulder.
After we had put a bit more distance between ourselves and that unsavoury fop who seemed to have taken such an interest in my companion, I said, "Farthing for your thoughts. As you'll have collected, milady, I was after learning whether Tristan knew of strands and the like."
"Did I seem at all familiar to you when I first met your eye?" he asked.
"So yes, he knew something of it." "Let's not bandy words," I said. "Whoever sent you, whoever you cooked up this plan with, knows perfectly well that it'll never suffice to do this on one strand only. Hence all of your preparations. Learning to pronounce my name, looking at paintings and noticing the colours of dyestuffs and such."
"It would be idle to deny it," he said with a nod of his fine chin.
"It's in many another strand that I'm even now meeting you again in like manner, walking these streets, having this conversation."
"As I understand it, yes."
"You understand it well enough, 'tis plain," I said, "and it's little trouble for me to wend my way to those strands, or snoiha, as we say at home, and meet with you there and then, and further enjoy the pleasure of your company."
"I would like that very much," he said. "Are there others like you I might work with as well?"
"Don't get cheeky, lad," I said. "Let's see how you can make things worth my while first, and then I'll decide if I want to cut anyone else in."
"If you make yourself my ally, it's quite possible, so think about what I might be able to offer you."
"Oh, I will," I assured him. "I already am. Now, if you've a good witch to send you," I continued, "have her send you to arrive yesterday."
"Why?"
"This is Monday. Had you arrived yesterday, everyone would have been at Sunday services. Not that I mind finding you naked in my closet each time you return, but it will be simpler if you arrive when things are quiet."
"Will you skip Sunday services to meet me?"
"If you want to pay the fine I'd be receiving for failure to appear." And since he seemed to be considering this, I said, "No, I cannot, lad. I cannot afford to be seen as shirking my religious duties. It's suspicious enough that I'm Irish and over here while there's an armed uprising against the English back at home. But you're not on the rolls anywhere, so your absence won't be noted. Come on Sunday and dress yourself, now that you know where I keep the shirts and breeches, and just wait for me. We were having this conversation as we came down King Street to the Whitehall stairs, where I planned to find us a ferryman. There were plenty of wherries out there, since the tide was heading out and traffic's easier eastward. I slowed my pace as I surveyed the scene. Then someone barreled into me from behind, knocking me off balance. I stumble and my shoe gets caught in a tear in my petticoat, and I'm falling to my knees when, faster than I can think, there's Tristan catching me and helping me to right myself. But in doing so, he jostles the rude bastard who's almost knocked me down. By the time I've got my balance and my wits back, that bastard has spun on his heel to confront Tristan. They're standing arm's length apart. I recognize him as the tosser who followed us. This fop, who doesn't look like much, hardly any manlier than Sir Edward, instantly draws back to a distance, puts his right hand on his rapier, and draws it out, no more than the width of two fingers, but enough to send a message. Other people coming and going on the steps give him a wider berth, but otherwise continue their business on and off the wherries. "Stand off, villain!" says the fellow with the rapier, pompous and angry. "What business have you touching me so rudely?" Tristan catches himself. "Good morrow, my lord. Pray excuse my abruptness." "Once you have explained yourself, I might." Tristan blinks, then says, "'Tis my sister you just knocked to her knees there? I'll let it be if you will." The fellow looks utterly astounded, and then laughs in Tristan's face. "What? That common whore? That slattern? She's not your sister, you lying knave. To she owes me an apology for being in my way." He turns to me and commands me, "Apologize."
"She owes you no apology, sir," says Tristan, very calm.
"Let it be, Tristan," I say sharply, and I'm using my best London accent, which Tristan notices with surprise. He's sharp enough to understand I've a reason for it. "Pray pardon me, my lord," I say to the fellow. "I did not hear you coming." Tristan says nothing, but the set of his mouth shows a kind of annoyance, and the tosser with the rapier notices. He draws the rapier a little farther.
"Do you take offence at my behaviour towards this whore?" he demands of Tristan.
"He doesn't," I say.
"Shut up, whore," he says. "Tell me yourself, sirrah. Assure me you understand this board is in the wrong here, and for even thinking of defending her, you are too. Say so and beg apology."
I recognize the tosser now. He's been a customer at the tear sheet of my mate Morag, the Caledonian wench. He's a terrible mean streak, and he loves his violence. It's not apologizing he wants from Tristan, it's a fight. Tristan is still standing there. I sense he's about to vomit with the rage, although he looks calm enough.
"To avoid a disruption of the Queen's peace, I will apologize wholeheartedly," he says, but of course that just feeds the fellow's ire.
"If that's why you're apologizing, I reject it," he says. "I demand you acknowledge your wrong for insulting and challenging a nobleman, and now you're being insolent as well."
He draws the rapier fully from its sheath.
"Will it take a taste of steel for you to find your manners?"
"I have no weapon," Tristan says, still quiet-like. The nobleman laughs.
"So?"
he says. "Would you strike an unarmed man?"
He laughs again.
"That makes it easier to strike him, doesn't it?"
Around us, folk are still hustling by, and by now we've missed a few wherries. I want to catch one while the tide is with us, and I certainly don't want to get ourselves stuck here. Now the nobleman looks around, as if expecting an admiring crowd. In truth, almost everyone's giving us a wide berth. There are only two exceptions. Standing off at a distance, observing matters carefully, is a gentleman with a long, sharp yellow beard, dressed in those sorts of clothes that look dark at first glance, but on closer examination are splendid. Closer to hand, three paces behind and to one side of the tosser, is another courtier, old enough to be the fop's father, dressed as if he's on his way home from a Dutch funeral.
"But I'm happy to give an advantage to one who so desperately needs it," continues the tosser. "George," he says to the old git in the neck ruff, "lend this varlet that rusty meat cleaver you have hanging from your belt. I'll take my apology in blood."
Very familiar he is, and cheeky in his description of George's sidearm, which looks a perfectly respectable weapon to my eye. But George takes no offence. I reckon these two know each other well, and that George is some manner of retainer or vassal.
"You'll be fined again, Herbert,"
says George, who for one so long in the tooth and so weedy in his attire is, I confess, a bit fierce-looking.
"The fine's a trifle," Herbert says breezily. "Lend him your sword."
George tosses his cape back, reaches across his body, and draws the weapon, which turns out to be as old and out of date as his clothing. It's a heavy, single-edged backsword of the old school, such as you'll see Protestants toting about at home, the better to wave menacingly at Irish folk. He offers it hilt first over his arm to Tristan, who declines to take it.
"I pray you accept my pardon for all offences uttered," Tristan says. "I've an ailing mother in Southwark, and I would fain meet her within the hour." "If she ails enough, you can meet her in heaven in half that time," says Herbert. "Take the sword."
Tristan remains where he is. Herbert, without warning, slashes at Tristan's face. He'd have taken Tristan's nose off if Tristan's reflexes were not so fast. But like a dragonfly avoiding a bird, my Saxon has ducked the blow, grabbed the hilt of the offered backsword, and swung it around to face his attacker. Old George, no fool, steps back to give them room. A passing washerwoman utters a little shout of fear and scurries off, and suddenly I notice nobody else is on the steps now but the four of us, and sure I'm sweating in the hazy September sun much more than I was moments ago. The fight was fierce, but very short. Wherever Tristan comes from, they must use swords, because it's confident, strong, and graceful, he seemed to me. But I think whatever their swords are, they can't be rapiers. He looked like he was dancing, like he'd learned steps he could perform very well. But Herbert, although far less elegant and less muscle on him, was so accustomed to the weapon that using it was like walking or eating for him. Their fight moved them down a couple steps and then back up. And nobody watched overtly as they might back home. Here in the city, people mostly hurried away up on the road, or if they were on the river, they kept rowing towards the Westminster Stairs or the nearest sandbank to disembark. Herbert was wielding his slender blade like an Italian fence master, darting in from this angle and that, and it was all Tristan could do to set his thrusts aside with herky-jerky movements of the backsword. It looked ponderous even in his strong hands. Suddenly, I didn't see how, the backsword went flying out of Tristan's hand, and Herbert had him flat back against the stairs, his sword actually pinning Tristan against the stone by virtue of having pierced through the shirt, vest, and jerkin just at the side of Tristan's neck. And then Herbert stabbed it into the crevice between the rise and tread of the stone steps. Tristan was stuck. It seemed a fancy move from a fellow not likely capable of fancy moves.
"To fall for such an easy and old-fashioned technique," said Herbert, making a ch-ch-ch-ing sound. "A stupid error, and a fatal one."
But then a gloved hand came down, gently but firmly, upon Herbert's wrist. An extraordinarily fine glove it was, made of white kid with intricate embroidery. Herbert hadn't seen this coming, nor had I. Both of us looked up into the face of the gentleman I had noticed a minute ago, the finely dressed chap with the sharp yellow beard.
"Who are you, sirrah, and how dare you?"
Herbert demanded, and tried to wrench free of the other's grip, but the white kid glove held firm.
"I am the gentleman's second,"
said the man with the sharp yellow beard. He had an accent. 'Twas "the," he said, instead of "the," like a German. He glanced over at George, then returned his eyes to Herbert's face. Or perhaps I should say "I," for he was wearing a tall hat with a broad brim, gorgeously plumed, and in the best style of all the young blades, he'd pulled it down low to one side, concealing his left eye.
"You have your second,"
the German continued, flicking that eye momentarily at George. "And so the honourable tradition is that your opponent in the duel should have one also. Is it not so?"
"It is so," Herbert admitted, "but you do not even know this varlet."
The German shrugged, giving me cause to admire the exquisite silk lining of his cape.
"This in no way alters the honourable tradition, as you will know, being a man of honour."
And the German now turned his head to look about at the crowd of onlookers that had gathered during the pause in sword play. The scarlet plume in his hat wafted first this way, then that. Herbert looked up to see that there were now many witnesses, some of whom were gentlemen, capable of giving testimony and of being believed by a judge. The German's intervention had worked. Herbert's humours had cooled. He looked down at Tristan.
"Go ask the wet nurse how to escape next time, but first give me apologies, varlet."
The German released Herbert's wrist, spun away, and walked off into the crowd.
"I apologize," said Tristan stiffly from his awkward supine position. "For what wrongs precisely, sirrah?"
Tristan took a moment, as if trying to remember what his sins were.
"For daring to show such insolence to one of my betters." "Apology accepted."
He withdrew his sword, stood upright, and casually sheathed his blade.
"If it happens again, 'twill be your throat I pierce, and not the clothes around it," he said, then gestured to George, who had retrieved his backsword and was inspecting it for damage.
They walked down the steps, took the next wherry, and sailed off downstream. Tristan got to his feet before I could move to offer him a hand. He shook his head slightly, looking spooked.
"Well, there's a lesson in that," muttered he to himself. "Learning from a fight choreographer has its limits."
He gave me a reassuring smile.
"It's been a very fruitful day."
And to make a quick end of it, Your Grace, back we went along the Thames and back to the brewery. And then I sent him back to where he came from, which is farther into the future than I had dreamed. Hundreds of years, it sounds like. I've kept Ned Alane's stolen costume for his next visit. So that is the tale of Tristan Lyons, whom I'll surely see on many another snoiha as I wend my way thence. And in conclusion, let me tell Your Majesty that nobody in London seems at all aware that the Spanish are about to land at Kinsale. That Penelope Devereux, sister to the traitor Essex, has been divorced by her husband Lord Rich for having an affair and bastard children with Mountjoy, known to yourself also as Charles Blount, known to yourself also as Lord Deputy of Ireland. They have but one son, Mountjoy Blount, and himself is 4 years old. But I do intend to put a curse on him, that all of his children will be stillborn or idiots, and so that line will end. And now I shall close with great love and regard to Your Majesty, as I am off to enjoy my one personal indulgence, the honey love of a full night spent in the arms of my sweetheart. My life is naught but secrets that I either keep or destroy on your behalf. Sure, it does my soul good to have one small nugget of mine own. Whether I be near or far, may I hear only good things of you, my Lady Gráinne. Yours ever, Gráinne in London.
Diachronicle. Day 352. In which we fail better. I set up a vigil in the office, determining not to leave until Tristan had returned. What if our research about the witch Grania had been wrong? What if she was sloppy with her details and returned him to the wrong time or place? So, in a sense, it made no sense at all to wait. And yet I could focus on nothing else. I continued to collate our databases, determined not to leave the building despite the lovely summer weather. Weather not unlike what is outside right now, given in both cases it is July in a temperate climate. The whole day passed. Erzsébet took it upon herself to buy a used bicycle, with what she called in money, given her by Tristan for sundry expenses, and she began to map out a bike route she would take to Walden Pond the next day, if Tristan had not returned. She seemed to be hoping he'd be gone a while. Frank and Rebecca, who had left the office shortly after Tristan had been sent to the DTAP, called to invite us to dinner. This struck me as bizarrely normal when we were living under not-at-all-normal circumstances, so I declined. But Erzsébet, overhearing the call, insisted I call them back so that she could go on her own. A buzz from the control panel let us know that the ODEC door was opening. Erzsébet's face fell slightly.
"He's back," she said,
as if he'd returned just to ruin her social calendar.
"Now we'll have to take him to dinner as well."
"Don't you want to hear what happened?" I asked. I went to the glass wall and looked to the ODEC. Then, realizing Tristan would be naked, stopped myself. There was now an intercom system that we could use to communicate through the wall. I flipped it on. "Tristan?" I called. "Are you all right?"
"Give me a moment,"
he called back out in a hazy voice.
"Actually, give me 5 moments.
"Look at you, smiling like a girl," said Erzsébet, grudgingly amused. "It is disappointing to me you don't raise your standards."
"Don't you want to know how it went?" I demanded. She shrugged her trademark disdainful shrug.
"It does not matter how it went. It is only the first time. He will have to go back and do it again. It will be days before there is anything interesting to hear about."
"I'm calling Oda-sensei," I said, feeling uncharacteristically peevish toward her. Quite suddenly, I had a lot of energy and no clear sense of how to channel it. I sent them a text. Rebecca answered and said that they would, naturally, come at once. We all convened in an office near the ODEC that we converted into a briefing and debriefing room. It was equipped with gear for recording audio and video, though we had not yet gotten the habit of using it. Tristan smelled of the disinfectant shower he'd just stepped out of. He'd changed back into his jeans and t-shirt and thrown his damp towel around his neck like a shawl. He looked fine, although he was slightly distracted, as his tongue worked the small gap in his back teeth due to the missing fillings. I'd handed those back to him upon his return. They now sat before him on the table, giving him something to fidget with. He looked like he could use a beer, and so I got him one.
"I have good news and bad news," he began, after wetting his whistle with a swallow of old tear sheet. "The good news, the most important news, is that I believe Sir Edward will change his mind about his investment. I believe he will opt for the East India Company over the Boston Council."
"On one strand," said Erzsébet.
"Yes," said Tristan. "I realize I need to do it a few more times, although it might be worth Mel's time to go back to 1640 Cambridge, just to see if there's a difference."
"There won't be," said Erzsébet. "It does not work that way. You've already witnessed that. Why would you subject her to that unpleasant effort?"
"I think it's worth checking," Tristan repeated, "to see how much can be accomplished in a single go."
There was a loaded pause. And then Erzsébet said flatly,
"Well, then you'll have to send her yourself. I will not do it."
"You are refusing an order?"
"I reject the notion you can give me orders," said Erzsébet. "I am simply refusing to do something foolish."
"Erzsébet," said Frank Oda, ever the conciliatory force, "you signed papers agreeing to cooperate. Do you remember that in Washington?"
"I will cooperate," said Erzsébet, when it is in the interest of the mission. This is just in the interest of Tristan Lyons throwing his weight around, and I did not sign anything saying I would do that.
He's your superior officer, I tried tentatively, realizing it was a mistake even as the words came out of my mouth, for she burst out laughing and said,
him? He's not my superior anything.
She sobered.
I will send Tristan back to London in September of 1601, to the Tearsheet Brewery. I will do that as many times as it takes. My guess is 4 times at least. And only then will we send Melisande back to Cambridge to see if it has worked yet.
Tristan took a moment to look silently long-suffering, although in truth I think he did this just to humor her desire to discomfort him. Fine, he said at last. That brings me to the lessons learned. I had an opportunity to test my weapons skills, and I'm a little shell-shocked by how poorly prepared I was. Oh, grappling and knife disarms work as well in that age as today. Sword fighting is a different matter altogether.
He delivered this news in his usual clipped and business-like Tristan manner, but then paused, staring off into space, as if reviewing some action in his mind's eye. Frank, Oda, and I exchanged a look.
You saw a real sword fight?
Oda-sensei asked, fascinated.
Tristan seemed not to hear the question. He had slightly extended his right arm, fingers curled as if gripping the hilt of a sword, and was moving it this way and that. Meeting my eye, he pulled the towel off of his neck, revealing a long, superficial cut.
You were in a real sword fight? I exclaimed.
This seemed to snap him out of it. He let his hand drop to the table, where he went back to fidgeting with the disembodied fillings.
They have more than one kind of sword, he announced. It's not all just rapiers. There's an older style, too. Bigger, heavier. Kind of like nowadays you might see an older person driving a big old Buick sedan, while the younger generation is tooling around in little hybrids. I need to get good at fighting with a Buick. I need a combat historian who can drill me on the nuances of that era. My opponent did something very subtle that I wasn't expecting.
Should I ask Darren to come back in? Darren was the fight choreographer from Boston Shakespeare. We had sworn him to secrecy and hired him to teach Tristan what he knew.
Darren's wrong for it, Tristan said. He's spot on with the historical detail, I'll give him that. But the whole point of stage fighting is that it's supposed to look as flashy as possible while being totally safe. And I am here to tell you that real sword fighting is pretty non-flashy and pretty fucking dangerous.
I know who to ask, said Rebecca. She had turned herself into a resourceful girl Friday, given she had never actually approved of any of this. There wasn't much we would put past her. Even so, we all turned to see if she was serious.
In the park, down the street, she explained, in the evenings when the weather's good, there's a group of historical sword fighters who meet to practice.
LARPers?
Tristan asked, clearly skeptical.
Seeing that no one besides him knew what a LARPer was, he continued, guys who fight with foam weapons?
Not foam, Rebecca said. It is steel on steel. I can hear the din of it from my garden. They should be meeting this evening. I'll go there and make inquiries as soon as you're done debriefing us.
Great. If we can find one willing to sign the NDA, I want to book them all day tomorrow and the next day. Maybe even 3 days in a row. I need to get back to the tear sheet as quickly as possible, and I definitely have to be on my game.
His eye fell on the beer bottle in front of him, with its ye olde lettering and its ye olde artist's conception of the original Tearsheet Brewery. He devoted a few moments to examining this, as if comparing it to the real one he had departed only a few minutes ago. Then he turned to Erzsébet.
Here's the other thing. When I go back, I need to go back to a different day, the day before I was last there. How will that affect the strands?
She shrugged, but this time thoughtfully, not disdainfully.
It depends, she said. Nothing is ever certain. If you will not be traveling for a few days, I will spend that time with my summer logup and try to determine this. The more different moments you visit, the more strands there are to contend with, and it is an exponential increase in complications. I will tell you something. In the history of magic, it is a general trend that all new rulers wish to use our time-transporting skills to their advantage. But the more seasoned they become, the more they understand the complications, and the less they wish to lean upon it.
We're not in the history of magic, Tristan replied evenly. We're outside of it. That's sort of the point.
Thank you for doing whatever it is you're going to be doing with your, samologic, I said.
What exactly are you going to be doing with it?
Asked Frank Oda.
I already told you, you cannot touch it, she said shortly.
And I won't, said Oda-sensei, ever affable. But I would so very much like to watch as you do the work. I have been playing with an artifact of Rebecca's ancestress. That reminds me of your Samologip. Perhaps I could ask questions and you could explain it to me?
A smile.
I would be so extremely grateful to be a beginner at the feet of such an expert.
That's flattery, said Ersebet, looking pleased about it.
It is the truth, said Oda-sensei. Sometimes the truth is flattering.
She considered him a moment and then smiled. It was rare she smiled, and it only further emphasized her beauty.
Very well, she said. We start tomorrow.
And thus began Oda-sensei's initiation into diachronic calculations.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
July 22nd. Temperature, 82 degrees Fahrenheit. High clouds, mild breeze, barometer rising. All herbs faring nicely. Butterfly weed beginning to bloom. Anise hyssop approaching 4 feet, very healthy. Scarlet elder. Flowers past, berries not yet ripe. Vegetables. Kale and lettuce in containers coming nicely. Lettuce harvestable as baby greens. But I fear I planted the onions too late in the season. Generally less time and energy for gardening, to be honest. I am distracted by the distant clinking and clanking of blunt steel weapons in the park down the street, where Tristan has been learning the art of the backsword from one Mortimer Shore, a local historical fencing enthusiast whom I have recruited. Have been watching Frank and Erzabeth converse as she attempts to describe to him what her Samologep does for her. For all my years of editing his papers and carrying my weight at those awkward faculty parties in which fundamentally non-social creatures, physicists, were expected to behave like social creatures, I cannot follow most of their discussion. This is not actually due to the calculus or physics, given that Erzabet has absolutely no training in either field. It is rather that I find it exhausting to try to be essentially bilingual, which Frank is so willing to be. She speaks in her eccentric lingo, and he finds ways to respond to her with very simply layman's physics. When you say XYZ, is that another way of saying ABC? And she thinks, and sighs, and says she supposes so, if somebody is too thick to simply understand XYZ. After several hours of discussion, Frank thanked her, brought home his notes, and sat down with my shaggy family heirloom to experiment with what he'd learned. He has not yet shared any of his discoveries with me, not because he is keeping it a secret, but because he most enjoys bringing me into his work when he's accomplished something. I believe he means to construct a Samologep, / Kipu, / Shaggy Family Artifact-like object that he can use, whether or not Erzabet is of a mind to cooperate with Tristan. Although since she is the only one who can actually make time travel happen, there is no practical benefit to having a Kipu, unless she is cooperating. There I go, being a pragmatist, which is not how Frank is wired. The only other item of note, besides Tristan retraining himself for period combat, which I hope he is never foolhardy enough to use, is that our two young leaders, especially Tristan, seem to be growing tense about how long this is taking. I have spent 50 years married to a man who is delightedly preoccupied with the journey, and now we suddenly are working with those who care only for the destination. This does not, in truth, seem to match their personalities, certainly not Mel's. It clearly originates from higher up the food chain, the cast of characters we met around that conference table in the trapezoid. General Frink must be ultimately responsible, but it is Lester Holgate, Frink's eager beaver civilian toady, who seems to be on the other end of most of the phone calls and email threads.
Letter from Grania to Grace O'Malley. A Sunday of Mid-Harvest, 1601.
Auspiciousness and prosperity to you, milady. It's mostly Tristan Lyons I'm writing of today, Your Grace, as precious few other developments there've been, but plenty involving him. He must be in alliance with a proper witch, and depending on who and where she is, she could be useful for Your Grace. In order for me to string this together into a proper tale, I've had to wend my way to all of the Snoiha, the strands in which he has appeared to carry out the same set of deeds. As you and I understand, Your Grace, they all happened at once, as choristers in the church nave sing the same tune at the same time, but I cannot write many stories down in such a manner, and so I'll relate them one after the other like beads on a rosary. He has been sent to several strands, always on the Sunday and always with the same task, to convince Sir Edward Greylock to move his financial interests to the East India Company and away from some queer little joint stock company called the Boston Council. He wants this as the cause of an effect 40 years distant and all the way across the sea. He is not very forthcoming in his plans, except to assure me they have no bearing on Your Grace. I have not yet begun to pry him for important information, as I believe the longer I let him get accustomed to my cooperation, the easier will it be to twist him round my finger when it's time. So I will continue to knit myself into his affections. I've offered him the occasional chance for making the beast with two backs, but he never takes me up on it. It's a shame, since he's cleaner and better smelling than any other fella in the neighbourhood, except my sweetheart. It's the same each strand. He arrives while we are all at mass, dons the shirt and drawers I keep extra at hand, and then waits for me to return from services, when I unlock my chest and give him a few coins and Ned Alleyne's costume pieces. To keep him in the habit of telling me things, although small things they are, for now, I pester him for information on his future world. I've learned things that are pleasing enough to my ear, assuming he's not codding me. He tells me, of all the saints there ever was, it's only Padraig whose feast day is celebrated in his nation. He tells me the spirit of the Irish where he dwells is powerful. So powerful that many of our countrymen will hold a great many courtly offices. So great that it's our Lucrapone, used as a talisman by a guild of men who somehow earn their living playing a game with a pig bladder. I cannot fathom how this happens, but I will query further if Your Grace requests to know it. He spends the night in the bawdy house, and the next day we venture across the river. Tristan understands he must make the effort several times to see results. It's 4 times he's had the same conversation with the same Sir Edward Greylock at the same tavern near Whitehall. However, there have been 2 remarkable changes in the routine. First of all, when we enter the tavern, 'tis no longer Sir Edward sitting alone we see, looking across the table at the remains of some other diner's food. In these other strands, his dinner companion has lingered over his meal, drawing out the conversation. Finely dressed this fella is, in clothes that are dark and even a touch old-fashioned, but ever so well made. He's wearing a tall hat with a broad brim pulled rakishly down over one eye, sporting a scarlet plume. And when he turns his head to take note of Tristan, it's a yellow beard that comes into view, trimmed and groomed to a long sharp point. It is, in other words, the German with the white kid gloves, who came out of nowhere in the first strand and prevented Tristan from being murdered in the duel. He sits there quietly, listening to what Tristan has to say. From time to time, he and Sir Edward glance across the table at each other in a manner that is full of significance. Anon, he excuses himself and leaves the tavern. Secondly, on these other strands, we are chanced upon by the same tosser and the same weedy curmudgeon, Herbert and George, I wrote about before. As before, they follow us, and Herbert has a go at Tristan on the Whitehall steps. As before, the German's there, stepping up to act as Tristan's second. And you might think that Tristan would properly apologize and humble himself to avoid a repetition of the duel, but didn't he amaze me the first time he came back, accepting George's backsword straight away and disarming Herbert in a trice? His abilities, his skill, his confidence, all these more than trebled from one strand to the next. I cannot account for the marvel of it, but it does make him even more lovely a fellow to watch now. The German watches all, but does less, as his services are no longer needed, and doesn't he disappear into the crowd before he can be thanked. For Tristan's fifth appearance, things were different. This time he reported to me that his acolyte, a woman named Melisande, not a witch, has been to the nearer future to check the outcome of his labours, but those efforts have been futile. So he asked if rather than repeating our circuit of Whitehall and the Bell Tavern, we might discourse of other ways to effect the necessary change. This I knew to be my opportunity to start to work him round my finger. I might be able to help you, says I, if you give me more information than you have been.
Fair enough, he says, as if being fair were what mattered. What do you want to know?
Why are you needing this Boston Council scheme to fail? What gain you by that?
In my reality, as it now stands, the Council built something in the New World that we don't want there. A factory. But it's in the way of where a house should be, a house that had been there when we began our efforts. We need the house to still be there, meaning we need the factory to never have been built.
Righto. But why were you meddling there to start with? Surely, in your future world full of handsome creatures such as yourself, there is little enough you could gain by going to visit some house in the wilderness. What was there for you? He grimaced, for he wasn't in the humour to go into it. But eventually, didn't I coax from him his story, that being, he and brethren were attempting to make a small fortune for themselves by secreting away an item, a printed book, that was easy enough to get in 1640, but near impossible to get in Tristan's age, making it of great worth. So you're thieves and chancers, said I approvingly.
No, he objected. It is a strategy. The money is not to save us from having to labor for a living. It is what we need to be able to labor for a living.
Seems peculiar, I said. You're saying once you've the money in hand, enough to live on for the rest of your days, in leisure and doing whatever you like, instead of doing that, you'd be using the money for something that requires you to toil more than you'd have to without the money. Be you daft?
The labor we want to do is important work. It means far more to us to do that work than to simply live a life of leisure.
I laughed at him. So it's Protestant you be, I said, or farmers. Sure none else would make that choice.
Would you not? He asked.
Is there nothing in the world that means so much to you that if you were given treasure, you would use it not for yourself, but to support and protect the thing you love? And then didn't I shut my mouth and nod, for I understood him. That is why we need the money, he said, that we can do our work. And what be your work? I asked, of course, and of course he answered, classified. I shrugged then. I can't help you figure out how to accomplish something if you won't be telling me what you're trying to accomplish, I said. All that matters is for the factory to disappear so that we still have a place to hide the book. So you say. But I need to know the nature of your work so I know if it's something I want to be abetting. What if it's against the interests of Ireland for all you say we prosper over there in your new world? It's got nothing at all to do with Ireland, he insisted. Then tell me what it's got to do with. From where I sit, the only thing you've got to offer me, besides telling Sir Edward to spend his whoring largesse with me and my sisters, is that you've knowledge I have not. That's the cost of my assisting you. Knowledge. Start with something simple, such as what it is you're doing, in the bigger sense, I mean. He grimaced. Sat for a bit, he did, as if chewing over the diet of truth in his mind. Then he finally presented this bit of business to me. In the future, long after you are dead, but long before I am born, magic is completely done away with. That's impossible, I said. I gain nothing by dishonesty, he said. I have nothing to offer you but truth. What destroys it? Is it the Inquisition? Those idiot priests go chasing after innocent women, as if real witches would let themselves be caught and tortured and killed. Almost by definition, anyone who is caught and tortured and doesn't free themselves by magic has no magic powers. It's simple reason. Is it the Inquisition? How do they ever manage it, thick as they are? He shook his head. How magic disappears is a separate conversation for another time. What matters is that my fellows and I are trying to bring it back. But to bring it back requires many things, ingredients and props and general expenses that I cannot easily explain. There is only one witch left in my time. What? In the whole world? I exclaimed in amazement. To the best of our knowledge, she is very old, and when she was young and learning magic, magic was almost gone. So we are at a disadvantage in my time. We are trying to learn more, that we may bring that knowledge into the future and make sure magic is restored. Now it was my turn to sit a moment grimacing. As hard as it is to believe this story, I said, I believe you are sincere in telling it. Speaking on behalf of my sisters, I thank you for the work you're doing. Will you aid me to do that work? As much as I can, I said, although many's the questions I still have about this, more now than before you told me anything at all. I realize it's a lot to hear all at once, said Tristan Lyons. I hope that you will help me in this endeavor and perhaps others. For the sake of my sisters, though I never meet them, I give you my hand and my heart. But we begin with this one task. I, he said, once we have accomplished this, I will know better how to proceed in general, and I'll have more to tell you. Is right you will. Well then, we must consider other means through which Sir Edward would not fund this Boston Council. Perhaps he squandered his inheritance, suggested Tristan. Can you cause that to have happened? I shook my head. That would be the act of a man of a different character altogether, and so 'twould require too many other changes. It needs must be a simple thing, one specific event. Perhaps he was never born, or died in childhood. That's a bit extreme, said Tristan, who I wouldn't have taken for the sentimental type. Plus, he has offspring down the line who are important enough to look up in the encyclopedia. In the what? He has important descendants who are not born yet. We cannot change the future that much. We must keep him alive. He thought a moment. He could put his money into the Boston Council, but the ships could all be lost at sea.
We do not exactly do weather magic, I said, save in fairy tales. It does not really work that way. Tis more specific than just raising a storm to blow a ship off course. More scientific it is, if you understand that concept.
I'm familiar with it, he said.
But let me look into it, I offered, and from behind the chest I pulled out my Oyeravon and held it out before me to meditate upon it.
You're going to look into it with a broom? Asked Tristan.
It's not a broom, I said, although I realized I did not know the word in English, as I've never the cause to utter it. His confusion was understandable. To him, it would look like a bundle of branching twigs, bound fast in such same manner as a sweep broom. And indeed, haven't I heard tell of witches who sweep the floor with their oyravon as a way to allay the suspicions of priests and busybodies? It's a measuring counterhelper, I explained. It's a strange look you have on your face there, Tristan Lyons. Why would that be?
What do you use it for, exactly?
He asked, in a tone and with just the expression of an excited child first getting to touch a salamander. Wanted to snatch it from me, I think he did, but he restrained himself. It helps me to reckon the odds and the complications of all these undertakings. Without it, I could never have wended my way to this strand to assist you. You cannot play such games as you be playing without risk of very serious consequences. This assists me in knowing how those might come out. Carefully controlling his breathing, he was.
Do you know what a quipu is?
He demanded. I shook my head.
How about a somalogap?
What are you talking about?
We have, our witch has, something like that broom of yours, but made of different material. Flexible, rather than stiff, but with the same branching, many-stranded structure. She employs it the way you have just now described employing yours, to calculate the possible consequences of her magic. How does it work?
What an idiot question, I said. How does writing work? Can you tell me how it is I scratch 10 marks on a piece of vellum and you can look at it and learn every piece of knowledge in the world?
Actually, in my time, we can explain how that happens, said Tristan.
Well, then you tell me how my Oyeravon works, I suggested, because I've not the faintest idea. I just know it does. So that's the sort of talk we were having on that strand, Your Majesty. I did some readings on the Oyeravon, and from them we concluded that there was no wisdom in trying to sink the ship that takes Sir Edward Silver across, as the first mate eventually has some offspring who has some other offspring ad nauseam, and one of them eventually writes a book about a fish that Tristan says is important. And we determined likewise that there be Luma danger in trying to destroy the factory. As likely, the local American tribe would be blamed for it by the Puritans in the nearby village, who would then attack the American tribe, who would then burn down the whole village, and that imperils a school to be built whose existence must not be blotted out. All in all, it seemed to me his likeliest course of action was for him to stay the course, try 2 or 3 more times to sway Sir Edward, and then go back to check again. So, not to be putting too much emphasis upon it, we went, as ever, to the Bell Tavern, and he chatted up Sir Edward and the German, and back we came to the brewery. I do so love that sword fight, and on certain strands Tristan is a marvel. Although, in fairness, he now knows Herbert's style very well. Poor Herbert has no idea what he is getting into, and moreover seems increasingly distracted by the queer feeling that this has all happened to him before. Then I sent him direct to 1640 in America for the economy of time by checking for himself if the change had been made. I don't know if he'll home to his own time or back to me, but in either case it's here he'll return on some other strand, and I shall keep working on him to learn something. His talk of the loss of magic is distressing to me, although it will happen long enough from now that it shall have no bearing on Your Grace's plans. little to report in other news, as I just wrote you so recently. At the Globe, they brought back Will's comedy, As You Like It, which I went to see, although it irks me to see him nicking Your Grace's own story, for Rosalind is a thinly disguised Grace O'Malley, as they call you here, and doesn't all of London know it. A grand enough play it is, but only one line of true beauty in it. Whoever loved who loved not at first sight? And isn't that a line he stole from Kit Marlowe? And furthermore, didn't Kit write that line about meeting me? My poor dead Kit. That poxy arse Will Shakespeare. He's even the effrontery to speak obliquely of my sweetheart's demise, for when Will Kemp, as the fool Touchstone, refers to a great reckoning in a little room, don't we all know he means Kit being murdered in that pub brawl? Having finished my message to you, I'm off to dispel my melancholy with my paramour. If I told you who 'twas, you would not believe me, is how discreet I'm being. Whether I be near or far, may I hear only good things of you, my Lady Grainne. Yours ever, Grainne in London.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
August 1st. Temperature 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Extremely muggy. Barometer falling. Hopefully rain to come. Container garden on front steps. Kale, harvestable, but bitter due to the heat. New generation of lettuce coming in fine. Onions will be ready soon, to my surprise. The rest of it makes do on its own. Have put in an irrigation system as I am growing forgetful of the water rotations. Almost a relief not to have an entire vegetable garden to weed and oversee. How did I ever have the time and energy? I would even forget to feed the cats if they did not remind me. Frank continues to crunch numbers and create formulas to further understand the quipu, querying Erzabet about her object and then examining the witch's mop, as we call the artifact from the attic chest. Tristan agrees this is a priority. He has determined to save time by traveling directly between 1601 to 1640, if possible. Now that we have known compliant witches, inevitably KCWs, in both of those DTaps, but it seems foolish to do this without calculating the risks. And Elizabet, although willing to do it, has warned that she can only calculate so fast. In the meanwhile, he has decided to travel from 1601 London to 1640 Cambridge, but then return here. So far, without success. The maple syrup boiler remains. At least the yard is no longer getting dug up once a day. The other item of note is the addition to our team of a new man. Frink, the fellow with the lapels and the desk in Washington, has sent us his protégé because, he tells us, based on Tristan's progress reports, we need to boost our morale, take the bull by the horns, and generally make ourselves more of an historical nuisance than Erzabet feels is a good idea. His name is Lester Holgate, call me Les. And by a strange coincidence, is it a coincidence? He is the nephew of one Roger Blevins, who was the chair of Millisande's department at Harvard. Rather than attempt to describe Les and his effect on the team, I attach a hard copy of a PowerPoint presentation that he accidentally emailed to me.
Slide 1. Classified. Interim sit-rep. Operation Bolster Gains. From Lester Les Holgate, currently embedded Dodo Site Prime, Cambridge, Massachusetts. 2. Frink, eyes only. Slide 2. Dodo progress to date. Key personnel recruited and papered. Professor Blevins, Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, Dr. Stokes, auxiliary personnel, Dr. Oda, Rebecca East Oda. The asset, Elizabeth Carpathy, real name, date of birth unknown, foreign national. The asset's personal computational device. Smologep. Spelling? Functioning ODEC. Magic. Diachronic transport confirmed. Multiple insertions recoveries of two DOERS, Stokes and Lyons, to two DTAPs,